I love talking to interesting human beings, but of all the entrepreneurs, actors, sports people that we've had on the podcast, they're in one category, and then the authors are in another category. You read the title right. It's about Kama Sutra. It's about relationships. It's about love. But this is one of the most knowledge-heavy podcasts. A great man once said that if you want to become a good writer, first, you've got to be a great reader. You've got to consume a large amount of content to be able to write fantastically. Seema Anand is one of the most renowned people when it comes to the world of Indian mythology, Indian history, Kama Sutra, the Indian epics, just Indian text in general. She's one of the people who's consumed the most amount of ancient Indian wisdom. So it was a long conversation that I had with her, but I was asking her all the questions I've always wondered of. She's read the Shastras, she's read books on yoga, she's read the Kama Sutra in detail, and keep in mind, please, Kama Sutra is not just a book about sex. So what is it a book about? That's not for me to explain to you. That's for you to understand through this podcast. She's sitting in London, we're sitting in Mumbai. The lockdown has forced us to create this form of content where we're creating content over video calls. But man, if you get through this entire long, heavy episode, it's going to change a few perspectives of yours thanks to ancient Indian knowledge. And as usual, if it gets too heavy for you to consume this podcast in one go, log on to YouTube, search for The Ranveer Show Clips for bite-sized, snackable pieces of this podcast. Seema Anand on The Ranveer Show. This one's heavy, but this one is value-adding. Enjoy yourselves, guys. Ms. Seema Anand, how are you?
I'm very good, Ranveer. How are you?
I'm great. This is a dream podcast for me. Before I talk about why it's a dream podcast, I want to introduce you to my audience. So, Ms. Anand is one of the foremost voices, the foremost modern voices on the world of the Kama Sutra. She's one of the world's most renowned authors, narrative practitioners, and mythologists. And today she's on The Ranveer Show.
It's lovely to be over here, Ranveer.
Ma'am, so honestly, I feel like the world of the Indian internet, especially from a youth standpoint, is obsessed with sex. And in more modern times, this concept of nofap and celibacy, especially the male audiences. So before we begin talking about those topics, I'd like to ask you how you'd explain the world of the Kama Sutra in the most simple way. How would you explain it to a 20-year-old?
So, interestingly, I've discovered that the Kama Sutra, like you said, if I have to actually explain it in the shortest possible way, Kama Sutra is about pleasure, not about sex. Okay? Sex is a very physical act that anybody can indulge in, the act of sex. Pleasure is something that only the human mind can actually understand and indulge in. Pleasure is a much longer lasting thing, and it's actually extremely good for you, and it is something that actually takes you to a whole different height. It's supposed to elevate you. It's supposed to make you reach certain heights that you can't otherwise reach.
But what do you mean by height? You mean in terms of human experience?
I mean literally in terms of human experience. I mean in terms of elevating the mind. So this is what it was written for. Vatsyayan, who is the author of the Kama Sutra, actually says this in his introduction. He says that, you know, the idea is, so as we talk about it, we'll talk about how elegant and beautiful and refined this whole world is. It's nothing like we think of the act of sex today. And it talks about this refinement and this beauty in such a way, because in ancient times they believed that everything had to start from the point of physical intimacy. So actually, I'm going to give you a little example of it and probably explain it better. Every time a king came to the throne, they would have a version of the Kama Sutra commissioned for their kingdom. So there's not just one Kama Sutra, there are thousands of them. And each time they had it commissioned, they believed that If a couple could share really, really good, mutually pleasurable intimacy, that means that the relationship would be stable. If the relationship was stable, society would be stable. If society was stable, the kingdom would be stable.
Beautiful.
So this was about the bigger picture. It was about, they literally believed back in that time that success in any part of your life, whether you were a warrior, whether you're an economist, whether you're a trader, whatever it is that you did, success in any part of your life depended on your success in your physical, intimate life. And eventually, if the aim is to reach God, all love has to first begin at the physical level before you can start to elevate it. So I guess that's what I mean when I say that, you know, it, and hence it's not about sex, because sex, the act of sex is on its own, it doesn't mean very much. It was about pleasure. It was about arousal. It was about desire. Because of course, in ancient times, again, we believed that the highest form of energy is the sexual energy. I mean, you're a sports person, you know that if you're out there running or doing a certain amount of exercise, it gets your metabolism going. They believe that when you have arousal, when you're in the state of pleasure and elevating pleasure, there is more metabolism in your body than even when you exercise, because every part of your body goes into some form of activity. Your heart rate, right, your breathing, your hormones are being secreted, everything. And eventually, if you consider, this is where, if you carry this pleasure to its final point, this is how you can create life. Only God can create life. So, you know, this was considered the highest form of energy because it's that powerful. Hence, this was an extremely important thing in the times gone by.
Beautiful. So from what I understand, I do feel that physical pleasure was given a lot of importance, but sex as a concept was just a part of the world called physical pleasure. But in saying that, how have we transitioned into this modern day India where even the act of hugging is almost like looked down upon? Where if a guy and a girl hug each other, it's considered, oh my God, how are you having physical contact with each other? How did we transition into this?
So I think that as times change, things change, you know, the narrative changes. So I really believe that, you know, it's the stories that we tell, they actually create our identity. So if you tell a story of a man who comes home and he's drunk and he beats up his wife, but we say, oh, the wife was so good. She was so good. She never said anything. She was such a good woman. She never said anything to him. Then that's what you're expecting the good wife to be, right? Mm-hmm. So the stories that we tell around us are the stories that start to define who we are. And it's interesting to think that when the Kama Sutra is written in 300 and something AD, at exactly the same point in 325 AD, across the oceans, in somewhere in Turkey, the first council of the Catholic Church is set up. And they immediately from setting up start saying how bad is pleasure, how bad is the body, that sex is the road to hell. On the other side, across the oceans, on the banks of the river Ganges, Vatsyayana is sitting and he's writing the Kama Sutra. And he's saying, how good is pleasure? How beautiful it is. It's the path to heaven. So we have two narratives that come up at the same time. This narrative from the West does permeate our nation quite strongly, because as you know, India has always been invaded and occupied since time began, almost, you know, from the time of the Mauryas. When you think about the 5th, 6th century onwards, we've always had invaders who have always brought their own narrative with them.
So you think it was the job of the invaders, like they kind of brought these concepts of, oh my God, sex is taboo?
I think that, you know, in a lot, like I said, the Catholic Church, even at the point of starting up, starts to say that this is bad. Okay, and we think that the British came in around the 1700s and the 1600s. Actually, no, we've had the Western world come in much earlier, the Portuguese, the Dutch, and so on, you know, so they've been coming in. But also, like I said, with time, things change. So as people come in, as the ruling parties change, as invaders come in, they bring certain other rituals and rules with them and so on. So stories change over time. And it's just, you know, it's really, really difficult when you start trying to change a story back Because that's what I'm trying to do at the moment. When you start trying to go back, when you think about it, Ranveer, I mean, I'm much older than you, obviously, but I grew up in post-colonial India, okay? So I went to Wellams. I went to Lady Sri Ram College. I did literature at Lady Sri Ram College, 3 years of literature. We never studied a single ancient Indian text, okay? Not even one. So we don't even know what our past stories were. How do we even start to learn them? I can tell you anything you want about Shakespeare. I can give you every reference to context. I can talk to you about Milton from morning to night, about Paradise Lost. Till I came to this country and started to study again, I had no idea what our ancient texts even said. And when you think about it, the Kama Sutra was reinterpreted much later in life. So it's in the 1800s when actually there's an Englishman called Richard Burton who reinterprets the Kama Sutra. Now, what people don't realize is when I talk about the Kama Sutra and I talk about all these beautiful things over there, they'll always say, "Ma'am, tell me about the best version of the Kama Sutra to read." But that's not what it was about. You know, these texts, whether it was the Arth Shastra, whether it's the Bhagavad Gita, whether it was the Kama Shastra, they were all written as treaties. They were written almost in scientific manner. And all science in those days was dedicated to God. So they're written in the form of hymns and poetry. And they're not really, even the Natya Shastra, you know, the book on drama and dance, they're not written for the average person to understand. They're written in metaphors. So there are commentaries that you have to read to understand what they say. So if you go back to the Kama Sutra, the only thing that makes sense to the normal reader who doesn't know about what the other metaphors mean, the only thing that makes sense is the little tiny chapter on positions, because you understand what a position means. And that's why we've come to understand that the Kama Sutra is just about positions. We don't know what the positions are. We don't know why they were talking about. There was a reason over there for the positions as well. But yeah, so there is this point about it changes, the narrative changes, but if you don't even have the basic background of knowing what it was about, you can't actually go back to that story.
Beautiful.
You know, if you think about it, I mean, just to mention, when you think about it, even the, you know, like, okay, you take the Mahabharata and so on, you take a lot of the Purans. Over the centuries, those Purans existed in some way or the other. And they've all been depicted in some kind of statues and sculpture and painting and so on. The Bhagavad Gita has got no visual depictions till we get to the 1800s. It was one of those texts that was lost. When Mahatma Gandhi read it for the first time, he was already studying in England as a lawyer, and he read it the first time in a translation in English. So people in our country weren't growing up with any of our old texts.
And I also feel there's this whole wave of writers who's trying to bring back ancient Indian knowledge. That includes you. That includes Mr. Amish Tripathi. So my question to you now is that I know it's an extremely difficult question to answer, but I will still try asking it. So for a modern man and a woman, what are three separate kind of learnings that they can take away after studying the Kama Sutra the way you have? Just three learnings for men and three learnings for women, if you have to boil it down like that.
So what I'm going to tell you actually, Ranveer, is that I'm not going to give you three separate ones for men and women. And I'll tell you why. I'm going to give you three takeaways, but not separately. And I'll tell you why.
Sure.
A lot of people also come and ask me, what about gay relationships? What's the Kama Sutra say about gay relationships? Like I said, it actually talks about pleasure. So it talks about what gives a woman pleasure and what gives a man pleasure. It doesn't say that a man has to pleasure the woman or the woman has to pleasure the man and so on. The idea here is that we are talking about understanding pleasure. For me, the first thing that struck me was the fact that there is absolutely no bad language used in the book. There's no abusive language. If you think about our sexual vocabulary, all of the words that we have for our sexual organs are abusive words. Okay? We go back in time, they talk about all of these words with such utter beauty. Even the vagina, for instance, is known as the Chandan Mahal. The clitoris is referred to as the Madan Chhatri, the umbrella of the love god, and so on. So I think that the words that you use start to also define your actions. The moment you stop thinking of that as dirty and bad and abusive, your mind already starts to change in the way that you approach something.
Right.
The next thing is that it absolutely does not permit any kind of violence. So through the entire text, it says, in a moment of passion, a man might get to a certain point where he lashes out in a moment of passion. You can't do this. You cannot hit so hard because so-and-so king did this to his mistress and he blinded his mistress. So-and-so king did this and he hurt his mistress. You cannot do this. And constantly it says that you cannot use any kind of violence or aggression. And it goes so far. This is the first text that actually gives women a sort of equality, a platform of equality, and it gives women the right to consent. So it actually says that it is up to the woman to decide if the pressure or the passion that is being used is too aggressive. So it says that, you know, in a moment of passion, if your lover bites you too hard, if that love bite is too hard for you, tell him to stop. If he doesn't stop, you bite him back twice as hard till he stops. Which we always think is a really cute way of saying it, but it's the first time that women are being given the right to consent. And I think that's amazing. The next thing it tells us is that men and women both have very, very different forms of pleasure. For a man, the pleasure is like fire. It's very, very quick to ignite. It's very quick to put out. It starts like fire. It starts down there. It goes upwards. A woman's passion is like water. It's her pleasure is like water. It starts here and it goes downwards. And like water, it takes very long to come to the boil, it takes very long to come down. Okay? And so it kind of tries to express its education in such a way that men and women understand. Because he goes on to say, he says that men and women are left to their own. Their pleasure is never going to coincide because it's so different. So how do you actually go about doing this in a way that you both feel the same arousal, you both feel that pleasure in each other's company? And I think, so it's like I said, you know, it's not just the one thing, but and I think that it's just this idea of slowing everything down. It's about understanding that you slow it down because there are other things to do. The other amazing thing that I think is a takeaway from this, it goes out of its way to explain to men that women have a very different form of pleasure. And the first time or the first few times that you make love, if you are too rushed and if you don't make it pleasurable for the woman, you will actually put her off it for the rest of her life.
Oh, wow.
So okay. It actually tells you a man, it explains to a man how to go about it. Okay. It then says that the most important thing, I mean, this is like a big chapter in there. The Kama Sutra is made up of 7 sections. Only section 2 deals with lovemaking and foreplay or pleasure. It says conversation is your biggest thing. So before you make love, before you even start your foreplay, what is the thing that you're supposed to start with? Conversation. So it says that the man must tell the woman stories to make her shed her inhibitions, you know, start to get her desire going, etc. And he says, okay, at this point, you have to tell different types of stories. So you have to kind of tell her stories which are slightly gossipy or naughty, something that'll get a reaction from her, basically. So she's supposed to say, oh my God, you know, you didn't seriously say that, or, you know, or whatever. So basically, you're supposed to get her to shed her inhibitions. After making love, you have a different set of conversations. Because after you've made love, so before you make love, you're supposed to have a conversation that's supposed to excite her. After you make love, the conversation is even more important because he says that the way that you finish this time will define how quickly she comes back to your bed next time. So at the end of it, you have to now tell her beautiful stories of lovers who come together and they make love and they're really happy that they made love. Because you have to convince her now that actually what you've done is a good thing, and it's a good thing for both of you. So it's actually really, really, it's impressive the way that he gets into the psyche of both man and woman. And I think the most important thing I would like to say, and I want people to understand this, the Kama Sutra is not about teaching women how to seduce men. The Kama Sutra was actually written to teach men how to pleasure a woman, because in the 300 and something AD, men were not taught how to read. I mean, women were not taught how to read or write. So men were taught how to read or write. And hence, this book is written for men. And the patron deity of the Kama Sutra is not Kamdev. It's not the god of love and desire. The patron deity of the Kama Sutra is Saraswati, the goddess of music and learning, because it says that you can be rich, you can be anything, but only a man who is culturally really well-versed, he's the most desirable lover of all.
I have to ask you the obvious next question,
yeah,
which is that from that chapter which talks about rules for men, not rules, but guidelines for men, could you give us like 4 or 5 pieces of information for the young guys watching this?
Okay, so they basically, his thing is that first of all, you have to make yourself worthy of the woman. Okay? Hmm. Being rich is not good enough. He has a very long, you know, section 1 actually defines how a man should look after himself physically. So you have to look good for the woman. You have to learn all these cultural arts. So, you know, all these young men would have known how to play musical instruments, draw, etc., and so on, because you have to be able to attract a woman to you. Okay. And for long-term attraction, there has to be a diverse personality. It's not enough to just be one thing and say, yeah, well, you're going to fancy me today and tomorrow you won't. If you want either a lot of women or a lot of women over a long time to fancy you, you have to create a very diverse personality for yourself. So that's point number one for the young guys. Secondly, it says that talking about love or talking about excitement, or talking about pleasure is extremely important. But women do not like straight out, in your face, bad language. Okay? So he literally says, I mean, this is actually really good for youngsters for today, because he says that you should constantly send messages to each other to keep that excitement going. Now, in those days, you didn't have texting and WhatsApping. So he literally uses almost everything that you... So there's a whole vocabulary around paan, about how you exchange paan, what kind of paan had what kind of meaning to it, okay? So you give this paan, and it means, I really love you. You give this paan, or you send this paan, you know, you would send the paan. You send this paan, and it would mean, well, I like you, but I'm kind of, I could take you or leave you. You send another paan, it could mean that I'll have sex with you, but I'm pretty indifferent to you. You know, so there was different ways of sending messages. There were different pieces of jewelry that you could wear to indicate, I mean, that was for both men and women. Today, of course, men don't necessarily wear jewelry, but it was this whole idea of a secret coded language between lovers. And do you know what? Actually, a lot of psychologists today will say that couples or people that have more code words for nookie or for making love or for seduction actually have healthier relationships. They have a better romantic relationship.
Wow. Because you have your own internal channel with the person.
Absolutely. So it's like having a private joke. It means that, you know, you can just sort of close yourself off, even if you're in the middle of a crowded room. Suddenly that can be something to trigger a memory and, you know, it's... yeah.
Amazing. So, ma'am, I need to kind of take you away from the world of these books that you've read. And I need to ask you about the wisdom you've gained from it. So, say you enter a room with a lot of people now. For you, specifically you, what would you see in a man and think to yourself, okay, that's a very well-rounded person. That's an attractive individual. From the wisdom you've gained from the books, how do you apply it to your own daily life?
So I think that generally when I enter, so for anybody, when they enter a room, there's a certain type of person that they automatically are attracted to looks-wise. So I think that's pretty individual. I think, you know, that doesn't count for very much. But for me, I have discovered over time, interestingly, that I immediately go for somebody where I find the conversation more fascinating. So if I find someone who can talk to me about a lot of diverse things, I do find that I find myself spending more time with that person. So yeah, I think that when you enter a room, there's always a specific type of person that everybody is attracted to. I think that's very subjective. It's very individual. So looks-wise, I think everybody goes for whatever they find interesting. I personally find that it is the conversation that I'm drawn to. And I think that as time goes on, that becomes more and more the case. Or at least, I'm talking about for everybody, not just for me, because I've had people say this to me in the past, as they gain levels of maturity, that looks you can only focus on for a certain amount of time. It's a very short-lived amount of time. I think that it's always the conversation that will take it that much further, from 1 minute or 15 minutes. I mean, how long can you look at somebody after all? What keeps that going? And for me personally, what keeps it going for me is somebody who has possibly got the same wide breadth of reading. I really, really find that very attractive. You know, somebody who's read a lot and somebody who knows what literature I'm talking about. And somebody who has a sense of humor. Somebody who can make me laugh. But I'm not talking about the, ha, 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 you know, the okay, fine, there's a couple of jokes that you tell. It just, more and more, the deeper you get into it, it's about the subtlety. It's about how subtle you get. The other thing I find that nothing, if something is too perfect, it turns you off. It turns me, it's like a chocolate box. Something is too pretty, it doesn't go too far. So like even with somebody who's too perfectly dressed or too perfect looking or whatever, I don't know. Is there something about that person then that becomes non-exciting? I think there's always got to be that little something that is a little bit off. That's for me personally.
Got it. This ability for great conversation, can you work on it over time? And I'm talking about both the genders. Can men, women, or all the genders, can any human being work on this ability to be a better conversationalist?
Definitely. So I think that it comes at different levels. One is that, of course, you can go and do a session or you can do a few sessions with a teacher who will teach you public speaking. That's one thing. It's more than that. It's about widening your interests. You know, in the Kama Sutra, there's a chapter called the 64 skills, the famous Chonsat Kalas. Those Chonsat Kalas were not to teach you how to be a better lover. They were to teach you how to develop a more diverse personality. Because if you are interested in 12 things, you are able to talk on 12 things to me. It's going to be far more exciting. If you can talk to me about only 2 things, if that's the only thing that you can talk about, that's really going to limit the amount of conversation that we have, because those might not be the 2 things that interest me. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing that I really think helps is shedding a little part of your brain which says, ugh, this is not for me to talk about. You know, there's a lot of men particularly and young guys who have this thing about what they think is cool and manly to talk about. Shed that. Because I've had guys say to me, you know, like if we're talking about somebody and I'll say, oh my God, that guy's really sweet. And they'll be like, oh my God, that's the worst insult that you can give a man. And I'll be like, no, that isn't. Actually, I think that's a huge compliment from me because I'd like to spend time with that person. But it doesn't say, and then they will argue, no, 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 that's not it. When a woman says sweet to a man, she doesn't, don't tell me, I'm a woman. Don't tell me what I think and what I'm feeling. I get also a lot, this is also really important when it comes to conversation. I get a lot of people writing in to me wanting advice on sexual matters. And a lot of them will write to me and say, I like to do this and this in bed. Is that okay? Don't ask me. Ask the woman that you're with. You know, learn to talk to that person. So it's a whole range of things from saying, okay, how can you be a better speaker? Because you know what? Being a better speaker is good for you in every sphere of your life. Okay? Mm. I'm not saying that if you're not a good speaker, you won't be a success. I'm just saying it's a huge help if you can be. Okay? We call it in the trade, we call it being a better storyteller. Every leader till now, every effective leader till now knows that the only way to get somebody's attention is by being a good storyteller. It's when you tell the right stories. And that doesn't mean stories from mythology. I'm talking about generally. So be a good conversationalist. But my biggest advice is extend your interests. Learn to develop interests, even the ones that you think, ugh, this is not manly enough. Learn to develop your interests. You will automatically be able to talk about more things.
Beautiful. If you date a boring person, do you become boring?
I think in today's day and age, if you date a boring person, you're more likely to leave that person. Going back to my generation, if you married a boring person or you dated, a lot of people in my generation did tend to stay in that relationship for longer. It was just the way life was in those days. Yeah, you would also become boring because it would, unless you really, really rebelled against that and came out of it and made an effort, because it would kill off your personality also.
So ma'am, the world of yoga keeps talking about how physical intimacy contains a lot of exchange of energies. And they say that couples who are together for really long start thinking in the same way, become kind of one person if it's healthy love. Or even if it's unhealthy love, I'm guessing they exchange negative traits. Does any of the books talk about this kind of concept of an exchange of energy and exchange of personality traits through sex?
Yes. So it's a very common theme in all texts. I mean, particularly when you read books that discuss. So I must tell you that the Kama Sutra itself does not talk about the act of sex at all. It talks about positions, talks about the architecture of the positions, not about the act of sex. But there are other texts that do talk about sex. And yes, they do say that when you kiss somebody, okay, when you actually kiss somebody mouth to mouth for an extended period of time, you do exchange your energies. There is a transference of one energy to the other. I guess when you are that closely aligned, think about it, even if you sit in a room with somebody for long enough on one sofa, let's say, and just chat, if the other person is really like, you know, you will pick that up and you start to feel sleepy by the end of it. If the other person is really up there and, you know, buzzing and bouncing around, you will pick that up. So, yeah, definitely there is an exchange of energy. In ancient times, again, particularly in Tantra and in the ancient Chinese erotic texts, they talk about how to balance out this by certain techniques during sex, so that if you don't want to take the other person's energy on, or in a lot of the cases, it was said that, you know, you had the man would ejaculate into the woman, so the woman would get his energy, but he wouldn't get hers, and it was believed that a woman had a much higher level of energy. It was believed in ancient times that a woman has 8 times the capacity for sexual arousal than a man does. And before we come to this whole patriarchal narrative of saying, oh my God, a woman is loose because she has 8 times the amount of capacity to be aroused and hence she's very difficult to please. The idea of that was that if arousal is supposed to be the highest form of energy, she has 8 times the level of being able to gather, harness that energy, okay? So it was believed that a man cannot get a woman's energy because she cannot ejaculate into him. So there are ancient techniques, I don't know anybody who's actually practiced them, where the man, instead of ejaculating into the woman, could actually suck the woman's sexual fluids into himself and gather her energy. Yep, I don't know. Like I said, people say that they can do it. I'm not convinced that anybody can or can't unless they've practiced to do this for, I don't know, like decades and decades. But the interesting thing that they do talk about, and this is an easier one to deal with, is that the sitting position is the one that was considered the best, simply because then nobody is underneath or on top, which means that one is not giving the energy, the other one's not sucking it up. In the sitting position, you have an equal chance of getting each other's energies. But yes, they also said that when you have sex in the normal position, face to face, and you kiss at the same time, you then created a circuit. You know, you completed the circuit and the energy could rotate and within both people equally.
Got it. Wow. Okay. This is a lot of depth to absorb in one conversation, but I'm still going to keep going. All right. So the next question I had to ask you was that, have you read anything about occult aspects in physical intimacy? You know, like I know that Tantra contains some occult aspects. So let's begin this whole section of the podcast with you explaining Tantra to a 20-year-old. What is it? What does the word Tantric mean? What is Tantric sex? What is the world of Tantra in the modern day?
There's no such thing as Tantric sex. Let's get that straight, okay? So that for your average 20-year-old. So if I have to explain Tantra in a couple of lines, which is not easy, the ultimate goal in Tantra is to achieve God, okay? But they believe that everything is created by God. That means that you have to understand everything. There's no such thing as this is good knowledge and this is bad knowledge, this is pure, this is impure. Everything had to be understood so that you could actually get beyond this veil of illusion behind which we live. And in understanding each thing, you grow your mind. So you grow the awareness levels of your mind, which means that you open it up more and more. The idea being that you get to one point eventually where you are so aware. So we don't talk about subconscious and conscious. We talk about different levels of awareness. You become so aware that you are able to see everything clearly around you with the naked eye. So they, back in those times, they say that you can see the molecules with the naked eye. That's not exactly what it means. If you imagine, science tells us that the brain is capable, the brain has approximately, 5 million stimuli at one time, or something like that. It's bombarded with that. We pick up only a handful of them. As you grow your levels of awareness, you are able to pick up more stimuli around you. So you notice more. That is the final aim. So you kind of get past this veil of illusion. This is what they mean. When we talk about somebody being able to, in quantum mechanics, they say that if you keep walking into a wall a million times, eventually you'll be able to walk through it. So the idea here is that they say that you can reach that level of awareness, that you can see the molecules with the naked eye, so that you can actually disengage the molecules and atoms and find a way through that wall, that level of awareness. Now, we know that this is something that may not necessarily happen. You can't disengage the molecules, but as a scientist, as an engineer, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So this whole idea of being able to understand each thing one bit at a time, to grow your energy, to expand your mind, you needed the energy to do it with. That energy is, they talk about it as the Kundalini, and they think that that's what it's about. It's not about arousing the Kundalini. It's about that whole sexual arousal, harnessing the strength from it, because energy that is out of control is going to be destructive. So you had to build your mind enough to know that you would be able to harness this energy when it came your way. Hence, there is a great deal of, Tantra is not about sex, but there's a great many practices that are based around sexual practices or sexual yoga. The idea being to come to that level of meditation, to balance the mind, to grow the mind. Does that make sense?
Yes, I mean, I do have some amount of knowledge of Tantra, Antra, so I'll just give it out for the listeners. basically spiritual practices that are for general benefit, for unselfish reasons. It's referred to as antra, and tantra in the world of yoga is spiritual practices which are kind of for yourself, to benefit something within yourself. Am I right in saying that, ma'am?
Well, you know, again, okay, that's like a one-line answer to a very deep concept. But for me, okay, so, you know, the Aghori saints, for instance, you've heard of the Aghoris. Now, people are always a bit horrified when you say that the Aghoris are the ones who will live in the cremation grounds, and their practice is to eat a lump of raw flesh from the cremation ground, or the body that's burning on the pyre. But they say that if we say that this whole world is an illusion, and we have to get past this illusion, then there should be no difference between that lump of flesh and this lump of cabbage. It should be the same thing. This is all this world of illusion that we live within, this veil of illusion that we live behind. So it's not easy. And unfortunately, most of us don't have the capacity, because it takes a hell of a lot of inner being to give that up. I mean, can you imagine yourself doing that? I can't. I can't see myself even going down that path.
Right.
So I think that it's just extremely deep. I just find it very frustrating, because everybody who talks about Tantra talks about sex, and it's just constantly trying to remind people that that's not what it was about. If people really want to go off and actually understand a little bit more, there is a group of goddesses called the Mahavidyas, the goddesses of ultimate knowledge. There are 10, these are 10 goddesses, and they're worshipped only with tantric practices solely. The top, and they're in a hierarchy. So the topmost is Kali. The bottommost, incidentally, is Lakshmi. Even Lakshmi is included in this group of Mahavidyas. So Lakshmi is a Hindu goddess, a traditional Hindu goddess, plus she's a Mahavidya, where she's worshipped through tantric practices. Read about them. It's fascinating. Like I said, I think that the biggest disprivilege that we've had, I mean, the worst thing that could have been done to us as a nation, as a race of people, is that all our ancient literature was boxed up and put away and shut up, and we have lost all of it. There is just so much knowledge and awareness over there.
I have to ask you a question which might seem pretty stupid when you gauge it from, you know, just like a surface level perspective. But how does this kind of education, you know, you absorbing these books or these ancient texts, how does it change you as a person? Again, keeping in mind your modern day life, what will you gain from this? Peace?
No, I don't think it's just about peace. I think that it all boils down to understanding. You know, if you are going to understand the world, you have to understand yourself first. We all need role models, okay? Now, when I talk about strength, for instance, inner strength, our ancient texts all talk about building up inner strength, because it is only with that inner strength that you can deal with the world outside, yeah? So, you know, and our ancient texts always say that it doesn't matter what you believe you're going to face. The thing to do is to create a balance in your mind. So whether you're in a happy time or in a bad time, that time will pass. Everything will pass. It's all about how you react to it, how you deal with it. Right. Good times can distract you, make you lose your balance. Bad times can distract you. They can make you lose your balance. So the idea is not to learn how to deal with good times or bad times. It's to learn how to deal with your own mind, your inner self. When we come to that point, you start trying to figure out, how do I understand strength? Where are my role models? So it's very interesting, because our ancient Purans particularly describe this. When I say to you, okay, build up your inner strength, you know, from a philosophical point of view, it's a very big concept. I mean, where do you even start, right? Some people say meditate karo. Meditate karke kya karo? I mean, like, what then, right? What are you aiming for? So these stories were created to actually give you that understanding, because strength that you use at different times is always a different strength. You have to come to it differently. Unfortunately, what happens with the advent of patriarchy, the idea of inner strength becomes something that only a woman is supposed to develop. So when you read your books, when you read your stories, it is Sita or Draupadi that have the strength of mind. They have the inner strength. People like Indra or Arjun or Yudhishthira, all of them go out and fight battles. Their strength is of the muscle. And there's a wonderful chapter in the story of Durga, in the Devi Bhagavatam, where this is while Mahishasura has been created and the gods are trying to fight against him. Devi has not yet been created to fight him, to defeat him. And Indra is really, really angry. So he goes to his guru Brihaspati and he says, tell me what to do. I have to defeat this guy. Go and do a puja so that, you know, all the grihas are in my favor and I can go and defeat him. And Brihaspati says to him, he says, I can't go and change the planets. I can't go up there into the heavens and, you know, change the grihas. And I'm not a fortune teller. I can't tell you what will happen. What I can tell you is that you need to build up your inner strength so that you learn to deal with adversity in the same way as you'd learn to deal with victory, because this bad time will pass and eventually you will win. But when you win, that time will also pass and you need to deal with that. And Indra yells at him. He says, this is nonsense. This is for sadhus like you and for women, for warriors like us. It's about fighting. You just go and do your puja. Leave the rest to me. So, unfortunately, we don't have role models that we can follow. Mm. And we all do need role models. So right. I think that there is a lot. Also, if we talk about culturally, you know, I find that we're lost. Now we teach yoga. Again, when I was growing up in school in India, they didn't teach us yoga in school. It's come to us through a very long and convoluted route much later in life. And we all say it's so beneficial for us. So, like I said, you know, in the Arthashastra, Kautilya says that the 64 skills of the Kama Sutras are extremely important for you to do really well in business. It was about understanding so many different things. So it's not just about your stories. It's about understanding what motivates you. And, you know, I'll tell you something, Rinveer. This is something that I have learned. Okay. When I talk about the Kama Sutra, for instance, when I talk about the pleasure, you talk about the slowness of things, you talk about the beauty, the elegance, I find that our Indian audiences totally get it. When I talk to my Western audiences, you have people saying, oh, for God's sakes, who's got the time for this? Okay? Our DNA is slightly different. Whatever we might choose to say, wherever we're brought up, we all have a cultural background that we are not taught everything that we know. Some things are just part of our DNA. They're automatic learning. It's right. part of our cultural background. If we don't understand that, we don't get to the next point.
So, ma'am, I found this inner strength concept you spoke about really interesting. I feel like strength is a really wide concept that applies itself to like a bunch of life hacks and life skills, which could be the strength of focus or the strength of not being shaken in tough times. So I really liked your answer about, you know, how you gain strength from these texts, because that's something you can apply in the modern day. Now, speaking about strength, one of the recurring themes on the podcast is meditation. And we've spoken a lot about meditation on the show. But what I really want to ask you is couple-based meditation. Like how earlier on the podcast, we spoke about being in the same room as someone who may be slightly low energy and that pulls your energy down. What happens to the love between a couple or the energy between a couple when they meditate together, maybe before engaging in sex or before, you know, just having conversation? Does couple meditation play a role in making two people closer?
I think that anything that you do together is something that will increase your relationship intimacy. So anything that you do together and you enjoy together will increase the time that you spend together, and it'll increase the intimacy. Now, we also have this ancient concept about using different sexual positions to heal chronic illnesses. So when I talk about, when we say that, okay, the ultimate energy or the ultimate strength that you can get is from your arousal, it's your sexual energy, which you have to harness and so on. So imagine if you harness that, and then if you have a bottle and you fill it with water, and whichever way you turn the bottle, the liquid will flow through that. So depending on that, you build up your sexual energy, and depending on how you make love in what positions, you can get your energy through your thrusting and through different types of breathing and the way that your heart pulses. You can actually direct your energy through different streams. So you can actually use that to actually cure chronic illnesses, even things like low hemoglobin and stuff like that. Okay. Now, in Tantra, they talk about also using your positions to meditate. So there is a certain amount of sexo-yogic positions that are used. And in these, what's very interesting is that the first thing they will do is that they will mirror each other's positions totally. So if you look at any of the old paintings, you know, the miniature paintings and things, you'll notice that both the man and the woman are always in exactly the same position. So if one has one hand raised like that, the other one will have the other. One has one foot raised and so on. This, again, is about balance. So again, if you look at it from an engineer's point of view, when everything is in complete balance, everything is still. Energy is only there when it becomes dynamic. So you have a slight, you know, movement. You have your things move. So the idea is to bring everything to complete balance. So the sexo yogic positions are generally done so that they mirror each other completely. The next thing that they do is they actually calm the breath. So they will place each other's hands on the partner's nose, jahan par, you know, the nadis come out over here.
Yeah.
Just to calm the breath, because if the breath is too hard, then you're not in balance, you're not meditating. So all of this is generally recommended for if you were doing sexo yogic meditation. The only thing I have to say is that there are very few people who actually understand it properly or teach it properly. Most people are going to go down that same path of free love, free sex, man, you know, and it's not good. It's not going to take you there. So instead of going down that path necessarily, my advice is always do your meditation together. Particularly for people who've been with each other for a long time, take a lot of time to build up the arousal. Because anyway, the chemistry is such that when somebody's very new in your life, you're going to get excited like that. When somebody's been in your life for longer, it is going to be slower. So actually, the ancient texts say that it's better to be with somebody who you've been with for a long time, where the chemistry is not instant, because it takes you longer to arouse each other or to arouse yourself. And with that, you harness more energy. You also experience all the pleasure as it goes along.
So I've also got to ask you this slightly inappropriate question. I don't know if it's inappropriate or not. But is there a role of intoxicants in ancient times, in ancient lovemaking? Have they spoken about intoxicants at all? Like maybe cannabis, maybe alcohol, whatever.
So interestingly, they say that a couple of drinks are very good for you. Anything more than that will slow you down. In an ideal world, two glasses of red wine or something that was like red wine. And they say that one, it'll make your breath smell better. Secondly, it's red, so it'll color your lips a little bit, so it'll give your lips a nice sort of color. And thirdly, it'll get rid of your inhibitions. Okay? Mm. Anything more than that is not considered particularly good. But that's not to say that there are other texts that don't talk about it. But then again, it sort of goes into other arenas of exploring certain things or whatever. But by and large, like I said, the Kama Sutra itself recommends two glasses of red wine, because it says that's just right. Anything after that will slow you down. You see, most people don't realize that your body has this much, it has one store of energy. Okay, so anything that you're doing, you're taking the energy from that. So if you've eaten a meal, the energy will go to digest the meal first. It will not go to your sexual organs. So if you try and have sex after a meal, it's really not going to be great sex, because your energy is being used up to digest the meal instead. Okay, So ideally what you need for good sex is a really good blood flow to the sexual organs. Anything that's going to restrict your blood flow to the or to slow it down is going to end up in not good sex.
But what activities cause that kind of a blood flow? Like exercise?
Exercise, the best thing for you. They say, actually the Kama Sutra says that exercise is what will make you really sexy. Okay?
Hmm.
The correct kind of food is very important. You know, when people talk about aphrodisiacs, they're always horrified when I tell them what is the best aphrodisiac. There is no food that you can eat which will suddenly turn you into a good lover. Okay? Khatam. I mean, like, that is the sad reality of life. Nothing will turn you into a, like, okay, I'm there. But the Kama Sutra says that the best thing you can do for your sexual abilities is to get rid of wind. So anything that causes bloating.
Got it.
So you eat something, and at different ages, what gets rid of bloating will be different things.
Hmm.
It also says that you have your meal after your lovemaking, not before, if you can help it.
I have to ask you this one question, which I wanted to ask you the first time I ever saw your videos online, which was way back. How much attention do you get from men, like, after one of your talks? Like, you know, because the subjects you speak of, and also I feel like you're one of the most captivating public speakers that I've come across on the internet.
Thank you.
So, you know, what kind of attention do you get from men? And when do you know that someone's, you know, approaching you in a bit of a creepy way? Do you have like a kind of creep radar in your own head?
Yeah, you develop a creep radar. So yeah, they generally get very excited. I have to say, as I'm getting older now, I've decided to go gray, as you've probably noticed. This is very new. It's going to change that, because I don't think I'll have the same kind of... But yeah, they do get very, very excited. I have even had people thinking that I was specially doing just the talk for just them. So and I've had people approach me and say, oh, I know what you were saying to me. Like, you did notice that there were 100 other people in the room, but no.
Wow.
So yeah, so people do get, but I think that the upside to this is that it actually gets their minds going, you know. I find a lot of women, when they come to the talk, will come either because a friend has told them to, or they think it's going to be a bit of a laugh. By the time they leave in a very different state of mind. And I can see that change, and I love it. Because suddenly they've realized that this idea of pleasure is not just that one thing. It's not just that one sexual act. It's so much bigger. There's so much more to it. And that they can give themselves permission to feel something else. And that's what really makes it for me. You know, it just, and I think that the more people that go back realizing that pleasure is a good thing, that it is actually not a sinful, dirty thing. Even the creepazoids who come, if they can come and realize that, okay, we were in a room full of people talking about this, and maybe pleasure is not such a creepy, it doesn't have to be dirty or creepy. I think I will have achieved a goal somewhere.
What's your strategy with shooing people away? Like, how do you kind of politely say goodbye? Or do you just avoid the politeness?
It goes from different this thing. So initially, when, especially with a lot of Indian men, what works best is if I say, do you know, I'm already married. And suddenly I could be saying no thank you for an hour. They're not particular. But the moment they think you're another man's property, they're like, acha, acha, theek hai, you know, so they'll go. So then you really want to slap them. Some of them, I suddenly get very technical, very academic, and they think, oh shit. Then another lot, I will actually, some of them, like the, in recent times, you know, as you talk about it more and more and you sort of go, the more intense a conversation, a lot of them now get very scared because they think I will know more than them.
Wow.
And that would really show them up. So then they don't want to approach you either. And then finally, there's a bunch of them that I'm quite rude about. And I'll always say to them, you know what? I'm sorry, but you could not handle me for it even one day. So you should just leave now.
Why do you say that could not handle me aspect? Like, I mean, okay, what is the downside to your personal life when you're absorbing this quantity of information? Is there any kind of downside?
No, the downside is that I now am aware of myself. I'm an intelligent woman. I'm aware of my opinions. I'm aware of my likes and dislikes. And I am not going to be railroaded into something. I have a definite level of intelligence which I am not frightened to express. And that can be quite frightening for somebody. I have been married now for, oh God, if I got married in 85, 35 years almost, okay? And I always think that my husband has to have been an extraordinarily strong man to have dealt with me, because I'm not the easiest person, because like I said, I have a mind of my own. So we are two people in this house with very defined ideas of how we should be. Plus, I'm very independent. I'm not going to be told by somebody, tum idhar baitho, you can't do this. I choose to make my own decisions. I don't say, you get to tell me what to do. We make our decisions together and we support each other. So, and finally, I think because of my work and because of my beliefs, I also have a lot of friends who are male, you know, who are not just because this is my friend's husband, but I have a lot of friends who are men and they're just simply friends. So to have that kind of inner strength in you, to have that level of understanding that it's okay, she can have those friends without me getting supremely jealous and thinking, shit, what the hell is going on? I think that a man needs to be extremely strong. A woman also, obviously, but I'm just saying that traditionally a man has never had to be in that role. Women, on the other hand, have had to build up their inner strength because that's the narrative in our patriarchy.
So not that I have marriage experience to reference, but what I gauge about successful marriages is that you kind of need to be a reflection of each other and at the same time have enough differences to keep things interesting. Am I right
in saying that? Absolutely. You know, Khalil Gibran says something very interesting. He says that when two people are married, they should be like two pillars supporting the same edifice. That means that they need to have enough distance between them and enough closeness. Something that connects them, but enough distance. Because if you're like this all the time, it doesn't work.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Tell me about it. Anyway, no, ma'am. But ma'am, do any of the books that you've read speak about the concept of soulmates? Or what is said about soulmates in our culture?
So, again, I'm going to go back to this. If you think about your soul is immortal, right? So it must be the largest thing in the universe. When your body dies, that soul is there. There is not, it's not possible for one person to satisfy your soul. Okay? You are the only person who can satisfy your own soul. And at different times, there will be different people, men, women, children, animals, activities that will come in, that will feed and nourish your soul at a certain time. So I don't believe in soulmates. I believe that you can be super compatible, that you can find somebody that you have a really wonderful time with. But then you need to cherish that relationship by giving yourself enough distance so that you have other things, so that you don't make it stale. But yeah, on a personal note, I must admit that to me, my soul needs a lot of nourishment and it comes from different things.
Got it. And the last section of the podcast is all about a subject that I've been reading a lot about recently, which is modern day witchcraft. Do you have any kind of knowledge about this?
Yeah, again, you know, in the Western world, we call them witches. In the East, we call them goddesses. Okay.
Okay.
So everybody has within them a certain aspect or ability that you can do. There, I don't believe that there is such a thing as putting a spell on somebody. The Kama Sutra does have a whole section on putting spells on people. And if you read it, you'll be laughing for 1 week. Okay, because it's just so much nonsense. So I personally, even in Tantra, they say, oh, you know, you can put a spell on somebody. You can't. In Tantra, the idea is that you actually develop your own awareness to the point that you know how to handle something or you know how to deal with somebody. Because when you become that clued up, you know exactly how the other person thinks. From their character, you can tell how they're thinking. So you can't put a spell on them, but you can definitely talk to them in the right way so that you can twist their actions. Like I said earlier, an effective leader always knows how to use a story properly. No, there's been no effective leader without a proper story. You have to be a storyteller. Okay?
You need to be able to manipulate just a little bit.
Always. Mm. Always. Whether it's for the good or for the bad, always. You have to be able to lead the people a certain way. It's that simple. So I think that every person inside them has the ability, male or female, has the ability to be a witch, if you want to call it a witch. Or to be a goddess, if that's what you want to call it. We all have our energies and strengths inside us. I just find that the moment we give it a title like that, we start thinking of it in a negative way. Like whenever I talk about Tantra, people automatically say, oh, but there's this negative aspect to it. And I'm like, no, there is no such, you know, learn to listen. There's a negative aspect to anything. I think that... having said that, I mean, I truly believe that I must have been a witch in some life. I'm a bit witch in this life. Sorry, forget that. Forget in some life. And in Cornwall, in one part of England, there is actually a museum to witchcraft. Okay? Which is a fabulous place. But if you go there, you'll find that they have the most exciting things. Because in pagan times, there were different things that they would say were a witch's tools. So one of the things that they have over there, they have these little round glass balls, almost like a Christmas tree bauble. That's where actually it comes from, okay? So these Christmas tree baubles or glass balls were supposed to be a witch's tool because you would be reflected in it. Okay? And you could see your reflection and it was like, okay, I can see your reflection now. I'm going to capture this reflection, blah, blah. So similarly, in ancient times, the mirror was supposed to be a tool of witchcraft. So, you know, if you wanted your lover to come to you, so let's say there's a woman who wants this man to come to her and she wants that he will not be able to think of anybody else. What is the spell she would really put on him? She would surround her room with mirrors so that each place that he looked, he only got to see her. Everywhere he looked, he only got to see her. And he couldn't think of anything else. That was all he would be thinking about. So, you know, there's a different way of dealing with witchcraft. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we call them goddesses. We don't call them witches.
So I'm going to give you an account of what happened in my life recently. I was on a date. Someone I'd met over one of those apps. And on our second date, actually... she mentioned that she's a practicing witch, like that she practices some kind of witchcraft. So I asked her what that meant. And she said that she has learned to do spells from her family, like her grandmom was a practicing witch. And I did feel this eerie sense of her trying to do something on me as well. I don't know. It was just like a gut feeling. Honestly, I feel that so I meditate a lot. I meditate almost 2 hours daily. And it kind of makes you very aware of your surroundings, of the people you speak to, of their energy. And I just didn't feel the correct kind of energy. And that's what made me exit that date and kind of read up a lot more about witchcraft. And what I found is exactly what you're saying, which is that, yes, there may be a world of spells, but the world of knowledge that you gain from ancient texts, your practices of yoga, your practices of meditation, they're able to give you your own internal spells through which you can lead people well, through which you can, as we said, manipulate people well. And you can kind of work these so-called superpowers through your books. So maybe that also answers that previous question about what does this world teach you?
So you are absolutely spot on. It's about energies, okay? It's all about how you use your energies. Now, we were saying earlier that, you know, if you actually learn, this is what your learning is. You know, you arouse your energy, you harness that, and you understand how to use it. And if you also have got yourself to that point where you can recognize other people's energies, you know, every time now and then you meet somebody and say, God, I really don't like this person's energy. It's too heavy. It's like this. Or you say, I'm so drawn to that person. It's their energy. It's like this. And I think that is just what it is. It is that person's energy. It's the effect that it has on you. Because if I am very, very jumpy, it will have an effect on that other person. If I channel it in such a way that I want it to have a particular effect on that person, that will also come through.
Right.
So it's just about, it's NLP, it's the neuro-linguistic programming. You know, it is really, it is all about understanding your energies. And for this, like I said, you know, we have all these texts that go back into our ancient past that talk about building up strength, building up energy, dealing with all of this. And we don't have those texts, so we don't have our, we today, I find this is the other interesting thing. As a storyteller, people always come to me and they say, so what is the takeaway from this? And the thing is that as a storyteller, we always say that you tell a story, you let the story register, you let it spread inside that person. Everybody will pick up a different thing, you know, depending on what you have chosen to pick up from that. If I want to now lead your mind, that is the point I will come in at. Okay, so we don't say that there is a takeaway. We say that there is an, it's the biggest tool of influence is a story. Because everybody will take from it what they are capable of taking from it. Yeah. So this idea of the energy is very much like a story. You know, your energy surrounds you. You let it spread. You see what kind of impact it has or how you want it to impact the other person. And similarly, you want that to then be built up inside you. So you were earlier when you were saying about what good is it when you read these texts and so on. Today, we look at it very scientifically from words like neuro-linguistic program, from white witchcraft, from modern-day witch, etc., with scientifically laid out rules. The old texts talk about intuition. They talk about energy. They talk about strength. They teach you how to use it. So it's just a bigger area of influence that you cover.
Gorgeous. Ma'am, so the final question that I have for you is that if you could just, again, sum up a lot of the knowledge that you've gained over the years and just give the young listeners who are primarily men, and I wish that wasn't the case, but they're primarily men. So if you could give men 5 kind of pieces of advice when it comes to relationships and love life, how can they keep their partners happy?
Okay, so if I was giving 5 pieces of advice, the first thing is that men need to, or young men particularly, need to understand that their partner is not them. So that means that I am me and you are you. And it's no point saying, I wouldn't do this, or I don't think like this. You have to understand how the other person thinks. Take the time and trouble to say, that person is different to me. Maybe they will need to be approached in a different way. Only because, think about it from, point number 2. Think about this as something that will benefit you. Don't think that you're saying, oh, well, I had to do this for my girlfriend or I had to do this for my boyfriend and it's so stupid. Think about the benefits to you, okay? If you want something, if you want your relationship to go a certain way and you can understand how to make it go a certain way, it benefits you. So point number 2 was to understand that it actually benefits you so that you overcome that thing in your head about, because a lot of young men particularly, I find, have this huge issue about what their friends will think if they are seen giving in too much to a relationship. Point number 3, women or, well, since we are saying this particularly for men, and they could have either male or female partners, but generally speaking, most women like the idea of more conversation. A man gets a text message, he'll read the text message as it is. A woman gets a text message, she will literally analyze every punctuation mark in it. There is a full stop here. Why did he put a full stop here? It's just the way that our brains are made. It's just how it is. So I find that one of the nicest things that the Kama Sutra says is about this exchange of messages. You have at the moment texts, you have WhatsApp and so on. Use that to the best of your ability, particularly because most guys are really not very good when it comes to face-to-face conversations, okay? They're not very good at speaking. They're not very good at saying the right thing. But the text message can really be formulated to be perfect. Use it to your advantage. Flirt tremendously with your partner on text or WhatsApp. Use that to your advantage. Okay. Number four, actually try and develop more interests. I know that generally, I mean, I have two sons and a daughter, so I can tell you this, that when they were growing up, the boys would come back from school, I would say to them, "So what happened at school today?" "Nothing." That's it. Okay. My daughter, it's very difficult to get her to shut up. She wants to give you all the details. So guys, I know generally when they're with other boys, the conversation levels are fairly basic. It's not too much chatting. It's more grunting. There is going to be a need for conversation when you're with a partner. You can't suddenly develop that side of your brain that makes you a great conversationalist. Fine. Develop other interests so that you have something else to talk about. Okay? And finally, it comes down to communication. You know, instead of second-guessing the other person and deciding that, okay, maybe this is what, you know, this is what women like, or this is what partners like, or this is what we shall do. Not always, but a lot of the times, it's really good to ask, especially if there is a hiccup, you know, ask. If there's a problem or you can see that there's actually something coming through which almost could be an issue, don't try and figure out what you think would be the solution. Ask.
Got it.
It's the best way forward. I'm not saying that it's always going to be perfect, and I'm definitely not saying that it's going to be a bed of roses. It never is. But let that be part of the excitement.
Beautiful. Ms. Seema Anand, thank you so much for being a part of the Ranveer Show. I will be linking ma'am's handles down below, guys. So make sure you go follow, make sure you go subscribe. And any parting message for the listeners of this podcast, ma'am?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, we talk a lot about the Kama Sutra. And generally, when the Kama Sutra is mentioned, we talk a lot about positions. I just want to clarify why we talk about positions, because I have had this in the past. I've done a whole talk and people have come and talked about all sorts of deep stuff. And one twerp will always come along and say to me, "But what's the best position, ma'am?" I just want to clarify this. Okay. According to Vatsyayan, if you're going to have sex, if you're going to be together, it's got to be really, really pleasurable for both of you. If it isn't mutually pleasurable, don't bother. I mean, it's not worth it. However, the first thing about being mutually pleasurable is that the sexual organs should be compatible in size. So if the woman is too small and the man is too big, or the woman is too big and the man is too small, it's not going to lead to a very exciting lovemaking. However, you can't choose your partner based on the size of their, you know, like, can you imagine sending this in your one of your dating apps? What is the size of it? It doesn't happen. And so these positions were created to help to make the sizes more compatible. So if the man was too small and the woman was too big, then they suggested positions where she would lie on her side, thighs together, legs pulled up, etc., which would make her a little bit smaller. Okay? So the next time you go out to try and read the Kama Sutra, which, by the way, is extremely good for you, you know, it will change your life. Don't try and pick up the Kama Sutra. Don't pick up a book that talks about positions and forget about the positions for a little while. Pick up a commentary, which is why I'd written my book, which was supposed to be the commentary on the Kama Sutra. Understand that there are other things that create pleasure and follow that.
Gorgeous stuff, ma'am. Thank you so much for all this information. And I'm sure that we're going to be doing more episodes in the future. So really, thank you for being a part of the Ranveer Show.
Thank you.